So let me start with the first question. Very often when we discuss how developing countries should tackle the challenges of the 21st century, including, for instance, providing basic needs like water, sanitation, housing, healthcare to their societies, there's often a tendency and even an assumption that developed nations know better, and thus their socioeconomic prescriptions, etc., for development should be followed. But as you know better than I do, this approach does not always consider local factors, history, politics, culture, stage of development. And therefore, you know, what we are trying to say is that context is very important. So given that you have written about the different approaches to national development in our globalized world, particularly in the African continent, I wonder if you can share with the learners what you consider the key factors that developing countries should consider when seeking to develop their nations and with the prime objective of improving quality of life. Over to you, sir.
Chandran, thank you very, very much for that observation and also question. The basic fact is that there is no country that is not developing at each stage. And there is no country or people that are not developed in some elements in on other things. So when we categorize the world between developed countries and developing countries, we have made the first mistake. Because the first mistake is to feel that some are developed and some are not. You might be developed industrially, but underdeveloped ethically and culturally. You might be developed in terms of agriculture, but you are completely underdeveloped in terms of other things. So I have done a book on understanding Africa. And the first chapter was to clarify the frame of discussion that each continent, each people have developed standards. If you take Africa, for example, in terms of culture, in terms of art and music, in terms of moral life, or what you might call the way of communal living, there is something great about the African continent, which is highly developed. And there is something we find in the European worldview, which is not as developed as the African continent. We see them industrialized. So that's a matter to clarify as a point of departure. And my thesis is every people are developed in specific things and underdeveloped in other things. And we are all developing. All people are developing at each stage. Some develop into decadence and have to start all over again. And some develop into, you might say, height of whatever it is in terms of the criteria the world places and still need to do more. Now, for the African continent, poverty is real in the midst of plenty. There is no reason why African countries should be poor, because they have all the resources and they feed the rest of the world. 85% of Africa's continent is agri-land, agricultural pure land. We have all the minerals you can think about. We supply the world with the things they need. So on the levels of financial, economic, and we might say industrial development, Africa is backward. But that backwardness also is caused. It's caused by a history that has not been fair and polite to the African continent, to the African people. You talk about slavery, you talk about colonialism, you talk about neo-colonialism, you talk about a globalization that creates a globe and puts every other person outside. You can only jump in through the window because the door is closed. So the first problem Africa has is this entire matter concerning poverty. The other one, of course, is when we discuss education. But education has levels. You can talk about cultural education, literary education, technical education, and so on, philosophical arts education. But Africans have not advanced so much in terms of literary education, which is where the world in the modern times meets now to dialogue about how to take things to the next level. The African continent, many people don't visit schools. So I talk about school as a moment of education, but they are very, very high in cultural development in terms of behavior in moments where you say these are a cultured and really highly civilized people. Definitely, when you talk about technology, Africans are very, very behind. The technology, the modern technology I'm talking about, the IT infrastructure, A country like Nigeria with 220 million people has not enough broadband I'm using a mobile phone now. I cannot use a desktop because it will be very slow. It's dependent on a broadband that is serving so many people and has no access that is enough. So these are areas I mentioned: poverty eradication. I now mention technical education, which is an area, and education generally into a new world we want to have, a new world where people have equality, have inclusion, where diversity is respected. And this is where Africa is struggling. Anytime in the global field, African, and I mean Blacks, are giving an opportunity to perform on equal level, they always transcend it. Talk about sports, talk about music, talk about dance, talk about paint and art, and so on. But once you have to, undermine the system, you find Africans staying behind. They don't have the capital, even though they sit on raw capital. They don't have the cash capital. Someone owns a large piece of land but cannot take 20,000 shillings from a bank just because the land is not collateralized, is not accepted as valid for a collateral. These are the things we have to question. But finally, also in terms of the respect countries must have, the African peoples have been so divided in terms of the boundaries made for them by externals. And it continues to be a problem that if there's a quarrel, they say, you see, these Africans are quarreling. We must be allowed, and that's also part of the discussions moving into the 21st century, to redefine the frames of reference, to have the audacity to be, the authenticity to be oneself, without having others telling us where to lie in bed, how to make our beds, how to stand up, how to sit down, that the parameters are not made by one for others, but that we have a sitting, a place where all can sit together and say, you know what, this is how we want our world of human beings, because we have only one world, just one world. Our world of human beings want to discuss, the UN is a platform for this, it's not happening enough as we would wish, but that will be my immediate reactions to what you've said. And using values to integrate the entire vehicle as vehicle for education, for poverty eradication, for technical access, for international discussions, bringing in values as the moment where human beings meet themselves, the values of life, the values of respect, the values of collaboration, of community, the values of being human. What is it to be human in the world of today, vis-a-vis artificial intelligence and all the other things that modern technology is bringing? This is where Africa can bring in a voice and tell humanity, you know what, we are still all human beings. And this is the chapter I think Africa's civilization can bring into the 21st century. We are all and still human beings.
That is so well said. Only you can say it coherently. So can I pick up on one thread there that I really think would add to this discussion and for learners? Because very few people, away from Africa, even within Africa, really understand that some of the topics you mentioned. I love this distinction between developed and underdeveloped, but because everyone is developing. So you talked particularly on education, and you said, for instance, Africa may be behind for all the reasons, some of us know on the technical side and all of that. But you say on the cultural development, it's a very high level of cultural development. So I wondered if you could just give us a couple of examples of the relevance of cultural development in the context of the African continent, the challenges it faces, and also for many people who do not understand the concept of Ubuntu, if you could, please.
Very gladly, Chandran, and I will start with the concept of life. Only when we have life are we, and can we move and decide and be free. So that cherish life, that is seen in the concept of the family. When people, for example, do not have family as a point of departure, how can you build a state? On what model? So the natural law defines the African point of entry, that in many African countries, the family, the community, is the basis for everything. You are nobody if you don't have a family, if you don't have a home, if you don't have a village, if you don't have a community, where you can always get back to. So there is a harnessing point of being alone there in New York, being just the only person you know as yourself. You don't have a background, you don't have a history, and you don't know anything. You are just on your own. The loneliness you find in the West, that people are committing suicide, these are not issues on the African continent. So community is one. Then the other one is respect for elders. That when you are getting old, you are not expired. You are not useless. You are not just pensioned to do nothing, but that the youth resort to you to give them more wisdom, to tell them how the past is. That's why we have stories, transgenerational. Then you take something about those who have lived before us, the ancestors. The Africans don't say, you are dead, we are buried, you go. No. In most cultures, religion is even built around the ancestors. We call their names. When we want to eat food together, we say, you know what? We remember our grandfather, our great-great-grandmother, our great-great-grand-aunt. These are the things they said. These are how they tried to live. And we make them present. Another level is even the level of values. Africans believe that values must guide them. And these values are around life, around respect, around diversity and inclusion and tolerance. These values are many of the values of humanity, even the values of religion. The African people believe that you come from somewhere and you're also going somewhere. In other words, there is a meaning in life. And this meaning in life is about sharing. And around this sharing, you have the Ubuntu philosophy. In many villages and places, they are used differently. They use Ubuntu, they use Omona, they use Ibokwena. In different languages, you have together we stand. So the Africans, I mean, we are discussing democracy yesterday here in Nigeria. I was in government and we were discussing how is democracy for the African. Democracy for the African is not majority carries the vote. Democracy for the African is consensus building. That even though we know you have this opinion, I know you have that opinion, it's not 51 against 49. It is the consensus of the majority. So we know where you come from. You belong to this party. I belong to the other party. But let's really join together to make the world a better majority carrying the participation, the participatory methods of development. This is something you find in this African education. That's why you have in a family a Christian, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a non-believer, an atheist. All of them are members of one family. They eat on one table and they don't fight because of religion. There are people who use now external influences and forces, just like you do it in politics, in religion, and so on, to try to divide the African people. But the originality of the culture, and this is something the African continent can contribute to the world, is that you cannot divide people based on external factors because of our humanity. And there is this one more element I would like to bring it into the cultural debate, and that is the matter of I and we. The individual and the community. Professor John Mbiti will always say, I am because we are. Since we are, therefore I am. So my being is not just my being alone and being the richest in the world and owning everybody. My property has no meaning. My wealth has no meaning if it's not of service to the community. So if you come to my village and many other villages in the African continent, and someone says he's a wealthy person, but he's not bringing his wealth to advance education, advance roads and infrastructure, train people, support agriculture. People don't care. He's not respected. What's your wealth? You can live with your wealth in your hotel. But once you bring your wealth, and no matter how poor you are, but you are contributing to the society, you are considered great. And no matter how rich you are, you are not contributing to the society. People don't respect you. You have no place. And when you are not regarded and respected in your community, and you have to buy it by virtue of show and other things which Western modern philosophies try to put across, my people say no. So these are the values we think we can start discussing in the international community. And even the entire thing about killing people, decimating human beings, our relationship with the environment is one that must be admired. You don't just wake up and start cutting trees. You pray to the tree. You give it a notice because you need it. You have to call the community. You make a libation, then you take the tree out. But even if you take one tree out, you have to put 10 back so that one will survive like that one that went away. Africans try to preserve the environment. That's why you can't even kill animals anyhow. You know, when I went go to a shop like in Co-op or any of these shops abroad, I see 20,000 chickens slaughtered at one go for sale. That's the capital economy. The Africans in the villages, one can discuss the detail. They want to kill an animal because they have to eat. They pick one chicken. They don't kill 300,000 chickens and keep them for people who are coming to buy at a certain time. We kill them because we need them for that moment, and the others stay alive. So when you groom animals just for the matter of killing and business, I mean, we're looking at the mentality behind it. So Africa's mentality is that of preservation, is that of environmental protection, is that of the dignity of the human person, is that about life, is that about the essence of religion and meaning, is that of a cultural authenticity, is that of language, where you may not speak the same language, but you understand from the heart. And what I'm saying is not theory. I'm practicing it right now where I live, in Enugu, in Nigeria, and all across our big country and continent, just for some examples.
Thank you, Professor. So that's great, particularly the way you describe the sense of the community and the family as the center and how the community works. One thing I would like you to elaborate on, because I know, you know, as you know, a lot of stereotypes have been painted over decades about Africa. And so a lot of stereotypes. And one of the stereotypes is that African governance and government systems don't work, they are inefficient, they are corrupt, etc. And people forget some of the context. So I come from Southeast Asia, I come from Malaysia, etc. We have many, many of those. And you can't just brush them aside. But what would you say to, you know, learners, new learners trying to understand Africa and young Africans and people from Middle East, et cetera, about the fact that we need good governance systems? How do you build that? And can you share what that transformation maybe needs to look like, or how will it come about in Africa, given, as you say, the context, the exploitation, et cetera? But now that new Africa is having to be built on the ashes of the old, if I can say it that way.
I thank you very much for this question. There is no doubt that we need universal and guiding principles for all peoples at each time. We talk about the international, the universal, we talk about the particular. The particular situations can only grow, situations that influence them in such a way. There has been an intrusion on the African continent, and this intrusion is the reason for the stereotypes we hear about. If you come to a country, let me say a country like Nigeria, and you break them into, you remove Cameroon, remove Togo, which are part of Nigeria, and put them away, remove Benin Republic, and create other republics there, you have divided their people, okay? And having divided their people, and they go now into new peoples who were not part of them before, because the boundaries have been just arbitrarily made. Then they start living in environments where they have to say, do I know you? Are we together? Are we the same tribe? How come that we are together under one country, under one sovereignty? They have to start now discussing this. But they had it before, and it was settled. But the colonials did not look at the boundaries. They just created something arbitrarily and said, you go and sort yourselves out. So by that, you have divided the people, and now you stereotype them for fighting within for what you cost. That is one. The other one is economy. You have, for example, taken the resources, digitized them, arbitrarily like colonized them, made them part of your own business enterprise, and the people have no access. And for the crumbs that front of the table, they have to fight for it. And you say, you know what? You see, they're fighting for crumbs, but you are keeping the larger portion. Or you look at issues of corruption, where people are really, where Africans have no access to the world trade. I produce mangoes, banana, oranges, and all the fruits, tea, coffee, but I cannot sell directly into a world market. I must have to go through second, third, fourth agents. And even then, my goods are put under such pressure that I cannot even qualify for what another part of the world have defined for all the rest. So the stereotypes come when you have created rules for others to keep, and because they cannot keep those rules which you made without them, you now stereotype them for not being able to keep those rules, and it goes on and on. But we cannot say that we are not culpable ourselves. The African peoples must also know that they have a responsibility to themselves. Unfortunately, when we have to do our local elections and we have to find who will be a president in Ivory Coast, the French government has to impose an African candidate as the president of Ivory Coast for the people there. When you have to do an election or find a job for someone on top positions, internationals now try to impose a candidate of their choice over their own people. So the originality of your own voice is undermined. Your own people imagine to talk the truth to power and to speak for your own interest and to protect the integrity of the people, of the African peoples, of the interests of the Africans within the international community. They do not have a space. So those you impose on them become now the stumbling block, and corruption then becomes a way of life. Or also, I add one more, when people are given jobs and they are not well paid, because an environment has made it possible for the African monies to be internationally exchangeable. Why should it be only the dollar and the yen and the pound and the euro and so on that are exchangeable? But most of the African currencies have to go through other currencies to be accepted. Or you have an economy where all your money, if you think about French colonial African countries, their money is banked by the Central Bank of France. Or if you think about English countries, many of them like Nigeria, they have to sell their oil and bank it in the USA. So how is it that people stereotype you when they have hoodwinked and hijacked your authority? So you're just like a zombie. And this is where the discussions must start. If the United Nations, to which all of us profess, is a sovereignty level organization where all African peoples must have, let us say, their ability to speak out and be respected, because the principles of the United Nations are very clear. We now see that lack of putting those principles into real practice cause the stereotypes we see, and the African people are undermined. I go back for one more point. The African peoples, no matter who they are, owe themselves a responsibility, including those who are hijacked to undermine their people. They should at least have the conscience and the ability to say, you know what, I'm not going to play that game. I must stand for the goodness, for the progress of my people, because once my people are progressed, the international community at the same time is also progressed. So the stereotypes are invalid because they are premised on presumptions that have been concocted and have also been made by those who put the African peoples on the same situations. Allow Africans competition anywhere globally, like I mentioned, in sports, they excel. In games, they excel. In dance, they excel. In music, they excel. In arts, they excel. But once you now, you say in banking, you don't give them a chance. In global governance, you don't give them a chance. You pick those you want because there's no free competition. So the free market must also go into the free of here to really prove have a brighter future. This is my thought and Chandran on this matter.
Professor, can I ask you two more quick questions and then I will, you know, thank you so much for your time. So one quick question I have is, you've already mentioned the richness of Africa from the point of view of the percentage of arable land in Africa, et cetera, and that Africa could be the food basket of the world if the rules of trade, et cetera, also changed. So looking ahead, you know, when we bring the learners together from different parts of the world and we look at the world where we are in today with existential threats, climate, and of course the big issue of food security, what do you think an Africa in 30 years could look like? And what sort of positions, as you said, should the African continent with its leaders and its economists and others, community leaders, start to imagine as the future of Africa? Because the current trajectory is not one that's either sustaining the world. And if Africa copies it, it would be bad for Africans too, for the African continent.
And you are just correct. First of all, the future lies within us. And this future lies beyond us. The future of humanity is in human beings. Africa is the one continent that has more human beings, bringing them into the world. You have a population of 65% of Africans are youth below the ages of 30. 65 to 70% youth below the ages of 30. No other continent is growing in terms of a future built on hope. Because when there are human beings, young people, then you can plan for the next many years because there is hope. So the African continent is that continent that is bringing in fresh, young human beings into the global village who will be of service to what humans must be doing in our world, because intelligence built on technology will do some, but they need human beings to still propel them. Artificial intelligence, technology, they will continue to serve human beings, but they can never replace human beings. So the African continent is that continent of hope in the future, because they have the human beings to do the work. They have the human beings to be there. It's not those who are living and dying. When you look at some continents that are really aging and children are not coming in, then of course we can talk about the wiping out. Point one. Point two, the African continent with its resources, and these resources have been exploited in the past millennia. They are not exhausted. These millennia are heaven's gifts to the continent, but they have never been used for the people of the continent. So the future lies that a government and a world conscience will emerge that tries to say, you know what? We are all brothers and sisters. We must agree that these people have been badly treated and we must give them back what belongs to them. Many people have repatriations paid for them, restitutions paid against what they did for them. Africa has never had any restitution given to it, and the whole world owes Africa. But Africa is not even after that. Africa is just saying, allow me to be. Allow me to be and allow me to contribute, because there are a lot of talents who can contribute. And as many of them are allowed, one sees already what's happening in the US, in China, in Australia, in Europe especially. And so what Africans are doing, one's given a chance to contribute their own quota. I mean, I'm a product of Europe. I lived in Germany. I've been teaching in Germany and so on and so forth. I've worked in Switzerland and at the Global Ethics and other places. And I see how we as people of African descent are able to contribute to a world when they say, add their voice, when they allow us to do so, because often you are not allowed. Now, I see the agricultural potential of the African people as of enormous capacity. You can produce, manipulate food, and produce nanotechnological food, but they cause cancer, they cause killings, and so on. Africa has land where you can eat fresh food. This morning, I'm going to eat fresh mango, fresh orange from my own garden without having to process it through anybody, without having to sell it to anybody. Just on my land, fresh food, fresh chicken from my farm. And this is where we have land and we have people and we have space. But the other one also is on water. Africa has so many rivers. Nile, the River Nile, Niger, Senegal, Congo, Orange, Limpopo, Zambezi, the big oceans, the Mediterranean, the lakes, Chad and so on, Lake Victoria and all the others. We have a lot of water. And Africa, so you think about the Victoria Falls, but they're not being helped and encouraged to manage these water resources. Think about the entire Sahara. It's a big desert, but below the belly of the Sahara is water, fresh water, the world's largest water resources, according to the report of a member of the Club of Rome, a research project. So these are the things we must consider. And we see that the African continent and peoples, they are resilient. And you need resilient people, people who are eager to contribute. Just give me a space. Da miki locum standi et mundum movebo, the Latin will say. Give me a place to stand and I will at least move the world. Africans want to move the world. They're asking for access. Our young people are discriminated against when they go for visas to countries because people say, no, we don't want you here. But then these are people who are IT, you know, compliant, very, very knowledgeable, who will serve in many other things. But they say you are a black, we discriminate against you. So the entire issues of racism even comes into the equation. We have said at the United Nations levels that no race, no gender, no color, no religion is a discriminating point for any human being. Let us practice what we are saying and teaching, and Africa is the hope for the future. And on governance, the young people of today are not going to be as their fathers in terms of bad governance. These young people want a better world, and they are going to have their chance because they are taking over the plenary in the next few years. And you can be sure that the world of the African people will be a better world, which will even welcome people who come from the hospitality of the African people. Come, it's abused, but we are open to receive visitors and make them even our own citizens. So Africa will become a home. It was a home. It is the point of civilization, the Homo sapiens, the Homo erectus. All these are African generations that where it started. You know, the wise people, the entire ancientness of the African people, the kingdoms, many of them gone, but some of them still existing. But their values transcend time and space. This is what Africa can offer to the rest of the world. And we are very eager to go into a dialogue to make sure that on win-win levels, win-win, not I take it all. No, let's respect each other. Let's play it fair. The things we preach, let's practice them. Africa is willing to get this done, and we are really open to a new collaboration.
My last question, if you can indulge me, one last question, Professor. So you spoke about a need for a consciousness, and that's something that quite a lot of people don't fully either want to comprehend. They think it's very utopian to talk about a global consciousness. But you've also spoken very extensively about the need for purpose and values. You're well known for your views on that and how to include that in education. In a way, that's what we are trying to do in GIFTED, but to link it with science, facts, and then tell a global story. So GIFTED aims to inspire learners to align their personal purpose with societal needs. That's really ultimately what we're trying to do. Your personal purpose, finding that societal needs so that they can contribute to the redesign of society. So in your final remarks, if I can invite you, would you share your wisdom on why is it important for future professionals and anybody else as a member of community to learn about the topics around, you know, values, purpose, and the things that we are trying to inculcate through GIFTED and align their sense of purpose with a societal need? I mean, ultimately, that's what we are trying to do. You find your purpose and align that with societal needs. I wonder, with all your experience, if you could share some words of wisdom with our learners about why it's important to align those two things.
I would like really to thank you for bringing up the topic of consciousness. The human being's ability is being a body, physical, a mind, mental, and a soul that is deep. That's why when we talk psychology, we talk the deeper things that transcend. When we talk phenomenon, we talk noumenon. That's the language of philosophy. There is also, in ancient Greek antiquity, teleology. Everything has an aim. When I wake up in the morning, the first aim is either to have breakfast or to go to work. You just don't live as if you have no agenda. So nature has an order. The morning sunshine comes, in the evening it goes down. It's an order. The waters flow and they go take their levels, and they don't climb high, they go down. The air is there with all its chemical and physical natural synchronizations. So human beings who are body, mind, and soul have a rationality. Rationality is the ability to think and to coherent this thought in such a way that you can see the external in existence and you can reflect on it internally, and you can make out an agenda out of it. And you can even, from this agenda of what you've observed, seen, interpreting, mind, education, teaching, come out with a response. So teleology, living for a purpose, acting for a purpose. For example, when one says, I want to live in the service of others. I want to be a medical doctor because I will help lives. Some people say, I want to be a medical doctor because I want to earn more money. But some other person says, I want to be a medical doctor because I want to save lives. I want to be a lawyer because I want to defend people's rights. I want to be a clergyman because I want to talk to their consciousness. I want to be a teacher because I want to multiply the loaves and share knowledge. So there is a purpose in the things we do, consciously or unconsciously. But making purpose conscious, that is, why I want to go to universities to study, or why I want to be a military officer, or why I want to not just I wake up and anything happens, anything goes, come see, come sir, so, so, la, la. No, let there be an ability, but that's also based on opportunity and based on choice and based on background, because I may wish to do something and I never had that opportunity, I never had that ability or the money to go to a university and so on to achieve my ambitions. But purpose is a gift. And the purpose of our life here on earth is to change the environment which we met for something better, because there is always an opportunity for something better. If I come into a room, I can clean it to be neater. If I make my bed, I can make it. If I go to a toilet, I can leave it so that some other person who comes in sees the toilet neater than I entered. If I enter a place where there is poverty, I can walk towards abrogating poverty, that others may have better life, eat better food, wear better clothing, and all that. So there is a purpose in our lives, in the sense that, and that is where education comes in. Integrated education, not just education of reading and writing, that's what we call literary education. Not education just to know your subject of arithmetic or physics or chemistry, that's just direct, but interdisciplinary education that builds in culture, the way we lived, the way we live, the way we ought to live, into an environment where my consciousness makes me as a free human being to decide. Because the human being must make a choice. Not to choose is a choice. If I have beans and rice offered to me and I said, choose one, and I say, I will neither eat beans nor will I eat rice, I've made a choice. Because I've said, I will not take either. But we are born to be free, and we must be free to choose. And not to choose is even a choice, to quote Jean-Paul Sartre, the famous French philosopher. Therefore, in purpose and consciousness, those who develop curriculum in education should make it possible for an ethical, value-oriented education to emerge, where the human being assumes responsibility. That word, responsibility, verantwortung, the ability to make a choice, take a position, and stand for what we believe, and defend it also because it is rational, it does not harm others, it contributes to the common good. To live for the common good is a very good purpose. To live for oneself alone, for only selfish purposes, is a lower grade. But to live and even sacrifice time and energy that others might have it better, this is the consciousness which we think about that can help. So aligning these things with global learning, which is the last portion of the question and the discussion, is something that is possible. Human beings have all the abilities which heaven has endowed them with and nature has given to them. Human beings fly and go beyond all the other creatures on earth. Human beings are also creation. But beyond all creation, they can sit in Oklahoma and have a call and think about what's happening in Sydney. A human being can sit in Malaysia and communicate with somebody sitting in Nigeria. Animals do not do that. Stones do not do that. Water does not do that. Only the human being, because the human being has an inner spirit, and that spirit is strong. That spirit is where consciousness is located. That inner spirit is what Steve Biko, in the African fight against apartheid, spoke about: the African consciousness, the Ubuntu consciousness, the human consciousness, to be and to change and to motivate. So aligning it means people should also live responsibly to themselves. You must always ask yourself a few questions. Who am I? Where do I come from? Where am I going? Why am I here? What can I contribute to changing my environment? If people cannot answer the question, who am I? He said, who are you? I'm John Kennedy. That's not who you are. I am a human being, and so on. One must think deeper beyond John Kennedy, because John Kennedy is a name given to you by others. So John Kennedy is not your who. Your quiddity is your essence. Who are you essentially? Education must make it possible for us to ask the philosophical and deeper questions. And the deeper questions is that I'm not just John Kennedy. I'm given the name John Kennedy, but I am a human being made in this world by a superior being that is beyond me, and I'm here for a purpose. I'm here, and so on. And one must deepen that, and that should be part of education. If you say, who are you? Say, I'm a medical doctor. Your medical doctor is not Yahoo. That's your profession. But who are you? So these are the questions that make consciousness an alignment to ask each student. And that's what I do with my students. In my class here in Enugu at the International University, Godfrey Okoye, I do a course called Moral Reasoning. We reason morally. We reason because we have to question. We question against question, and we question the question. And it's a luxury, because some people don't have that kind of time. But it's a luxury we must allow ourselves for consciousness to be, so that we don't kill people and we live a decent life, and there is a happiness, because human beings are created to be happy, and happiness is what we seek. But we can look for a happiness that brings us into discomfiture. That it does not become happiness, it becomes desolate and it becomes discomforting. So happiness and building it up, not happiness that progresses my own selfishness, but happiness that creates a platform for all to have a home. And this world is one. We don't have two worlds. We have one world. And this one world is a common world. And humanity is one. We don't have two humanities. And human beings are all the same. They are body, mind, and soul configured as their nature is in different colors. But the colors don't make a difference. These are just the differences you see with your eyes. But the human being, all of them have blood that flows. So why must a human being in one part of the world feel superior to a human being in another part of the world just because you were born into a culture or into an environment that has exploited others? Time for a global rethink, because history continues to change.